them that if they do, and it was more than 6 years before he brought suit. And remember, this was the Chicago law firm that was, they know everything about black mold. And then we went, oh, got $100,000 in sanctions against them.
Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratvel, Judge Jessen, Judge Brian, the Honorable Judge Diane Bratvel presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's all be seated. So, good morning. For the record, today's date is February 13th, 2020. We are in the Minnesota Court of Appeals in St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to Council. I see that you're already seated at table. I very much appreciate that. I will ask the marshal to call our first case.
3rd-party plaintiffs, respondent, Verse Demo Unlimited, Incorporated, 3rd-party defendant, appellant.
Right, and I will make just a few remarks before we proceed with the argument. First of all, we very much look forward to our conversation with you today, and we appreciate that your detailed submissions in this matter. When you do get to the podium, please take whatever time you need to adjust the lectern. So we do have the microphones, and we are recording proceedings today, so we very much appreciate if you take a moment to make sure that that's pointed in your direction, as well as the height will go up and down. And then if you want to lay out materials, just don't feel in a hurry is what I'm trying to say, and then get ready to proceed with the conversation, and we look forward to talking to you. Now, I do see that we have respondents' counsel. I don't remember that we have a specific order in place. We have two briefs submitted by respondents' counsel. Have you made a decision as to how you're dividing time? And what is that?
I will go first.
Okay.
Sullivan Day will go first.
Okay.
And half and half.
All right. And you've already discussed those with the marshal. Terrific. All right. With that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Morning, Council. I'm Elizabeth Roth, and I represent Appellant Demo Unlimited Incorporated. Appellant seeks to have this court reverse the district court's order, finding that a mediated settlement agreement between all the parties included Demo Unlimited's Minnesota Statute 176061, Subdivision 5C, claim for increased workers' compensation premiums. I'm going to start out today first by giving a brief factual background on this case, and then I'm going to discuss why, under basic rules of contract interpretation, this court should interpret the agreement to exclude the increased premium claim. And then I'm going to finish up with the alternative arguments of the lack of meeting of the minds and then the lack of authority to settle that case. Going into the factual background of this case, this is not a standard, simple, or run-of-the-mill type personal injury case as discussed by the district court and respondents. This is a case that is created solely by statute. It is a work-related injury. It is controlled by 176061. And without 176061, or the Supreme Court's decision in Lambertson from, you know, over 40 years ago, we wouldn't even be here. This claim wouldn't even exist. So 176061 and the subsequent cases that have interpreted it have very much limited the rights of an at-fault third party. And that's really important here to keep this in context as we move forward with interpreting the actual mediated settlement agreement itself. Because as the court said in the matter of, or as indicated in the Brookfield Trade Center, Inc., versus City of Ramsey, 584 Northwest 2D 390, the Minnesota Supreme Court in 1998 addressed a tax issue. And when addressing the tax issue, had to look at the situation of the case itself and the general tax law. That same analysis should apply here. When looking at the mediated settlement agreement, you can't look at it in isolation. You have to look at it in context of the 176061 limitations. So this case involves a work injury. Respondent Cusick, who I don't believe actually appeared in this case, I think we're just referring to him as respondents just because there was no other term
didn't appear in the appeal,
didn't submit a brief in the appeal.
Right.
But Mr. Cusick was injured on a work site. They were converting what was an old bank into another commercial space. And to do this conversion, there was a big vault door. The big vault door was taken out by defendant Moses, respondent Moses, and leaned against a wall. Sullivan Day was the general contractor. Demo Unlimited was hired to take out other materials and to take out other building parts, not including the vault door. Somehow the vault door fell on one of the employees of Demo Unlimited, and he was severely injured. At that time, Demo Unlimited had workers' compensation insurance with the Builders Group, and the Builders Group paid workers' compensation benefits on behalf of Mr. Cusick. Mr. Cusick, under Chapter 176, which is the Work Comp Act, is barred under the exclusive remedy provision from suing Demo Unlimited in tort. So they do have, an injured employee does have a right under 176061 to sue an at-fault third party. Here, Mr. Cusick sued Sullivan Day and Moses alleging negligence. Before Lambertson, before 176061, respondents Moses and Sullivan Day would not have been able to bring any claim of contribution, period, whatsoever, against the Demo Unlimited, against appellant. However, 176061 subdivision 11 carves out an exception. And the exception is they can seek contribution in tort, but only up to the amount of workers' compensation benefits paid. So the legislature, in essence, is trying to lessen the burden on the third-party tortfeasors. But still, in the end, as this court in Fish noted in 2018 and as the Supreme Court upheld in 2019, the 176061 structure definitely puts most of the burden of paying damages on the third-party tortfeasors. The courts have recognized that, and the legislature has recognized that. So since the inclusion of Subdivision 11 to give the option for a contribution claim, the court has recognized certain settlement agreement types that the parties can use to resolve these claims.
So, Counsel, I really do appreciate the deep history that we have here, but I am watching the clock for you, and it goes rapidly, and I think in this case, at least the district court very much felt, and with some justification, I think, that we have a very particular settlement, mediated settlement agreement in this case.
Yes.
And that our decision on appeal is to review the district court's decision on how to interpret that very particular mediated settlement agreement. So I just wonder if you want to turn your attention to the language in the settlement agreement, just to make sure that we are following your interpretation. I appreciate that you're just getting now to the NAG settlement and
yes.
the fact that this mediated settlement agreement includes some very specific
yes.
notations about the NAG.
And that's important.
I appreciate that.
And that's what I was going to get to now, Your Honor. So if we look at the standard rules of contract interpretation, first of all, whether or not a contract is ambiguous or unambiguous is a question that's reviewed de novo. Had the judge made any type of factual determinations with regard to any of the defenses, then it would be an abuse of discretion. But whether or not it's ambiguous or not in his face is a question that this court can review de novo. And what's really important here is that what is being asked by respondents is for this court to look at one provision of the agreement, the broad release language that says any and all claims that could have been brought in the
well,
legal
I think
action.
It's pretty clear we have to read the agreement as a whole, isn't it?
Yes, and yeah. that's where I disagree.
There? So how about if we read it as a whole, we include the NAG language, and we analyze what is numbered paragraph one, that this will be in full and final settlement of all claims except for no-fault benefits.
Well, I want to bring your attention to a couple of the court cases.
I know that you'd rather proceed in that way. Well, counsel, would you interpret the language I'm asking you to interpret? It's so fundamental to this case.
And that's where I'm going with, is that the way that the courts empirically have interpreted contracts is they don't stop at the broad release language.
No, I would like you to interpret it in light of the NAG language. Would you do that for me?
Yes.
Thank you.
So then if you look at what the actual terms of the agreement says after that, is that it goes and it says in handwriting NAG and reverse NAG, and those are terms of art. Those are specific releases that have a specific scope of release. And that specific scope of release, as agreed by all the parties and even the district court, does not include the increased workers' premium claim. So in other cases, for instance, in Curtis.
So, counsel, you have me on the NAG language.
Yes.
The handwriting on the NAG language definitely doesn't include the employer's increased claim for increased premiums. I understand that.
Yes.
The argument that I'm reading in a respondent's brief, and I'd like to have you address in your opening remarks, is that this language, that it will be a full and final settlement of all claims.
That is.
And above, the party specifically stated, it's their intention that it would be any and all claims that have been brought or could have been brought in the legal action. So would you interpret that language?
That is standard boilerplate language that you find in most settlement agreements that begin the release. And then the release can be limited by additional language throughout it. And that is the basic tenet of contract interpretation, that you don't render certain language meaningless.
And I would be with you if we had this handwriting on the side about the NAG and the parties had struck out, the other language. But this agreement was signed by all parties to include this broad language that you and I have just been talking about. So how does this court interpret it under our de novo standard of review, except as we have to include both, right? We can't just look at the NAG language. We have to look at both.
Yes. And that gets to the Curtis case and the Calhoun case, which discuss how you interpret a settlement agreement. And what you start out with is you look at the broad release language, and then you go through the contract to see if there's any limiting language on that. And for instance, in the Calhoun case, and I understand that this is an unpublished case, but it does have a lot of persuasive value in how the court should look at it. And in that court, it actually says that the express intention of appellant by execution of this document was to release respondent to the fullest extent permitted by law. That was in the settlement agreement. But then later on, the agreement limits it and excludes environmental condition or contamination claims. So the court interpreted that to say that it's a broad release, but by including that separate language, you're excluding certain claims.
And this boilerplate contract does have a reference to an exclusion. You point out in your brief that the no-fault exclusion that's mentioned is irrelevant because this isn't a no-fault case. I appreciate that. We certainly could have had language along those lines in this case, right? It could have been something like, instead of saying in full and final settlement of all claims, comma, except for no-fault benefits, it could have been, comma, except for the employer's increased premium claim, right?
It could have said that, but by including the NAG and reverse NAG, that indicates that what the parties agreed to. The parties agreed that the scope of release would be limited to those agreements. So had they wanted it to include it, they could have also said this includes all 176061 claims, which would include the premium.
Counsel, if you could, it also notes in the handwritten notes, demo agrees to no comp future credit. Could you tell me on how that fits into your overall contract interpretation?
Yes. The work comp subrogation claim includes benefits for benefits paid in the past and potential future benefits. A lot of times, because work comp in Minnesota, you can't close out future medical benefits, for instance. So as part of the NAG and the reverse, as part of the reverse NAG, they need to discuss how much is going to go to the future of that settlement. And in this case, they said $20,000 is enough. There's going to be no future credit toward any of the remaining settlement amounts. So that does fall under the workers' compensation subrogation claim. The other indication
in this. Your client, Demo, was brought into the suit as a third-party defendant,
correct?
Right? Okay. So when you were brought into the action through a third-party complaint, you had the option at that point of asserting counterclaims, right?
Yes.
Okay. And one of the counterclaims you could have asserted would have been this increased employer premium claim,
yes,
right? Okay.
It's a permissible counter.
Right, right. Not a mandatory. I appreciate that. And I think the respondents have been straightforward on that as well. I noted that when Sullivan's third-party complaint against Demo included a claim that Demo failed to get insurance that would have covered Sullivan Day. Am I right about that?
My guess is that has something to do with the contractual indemnity agreements.
Right, absolutely.
Yes.
I assume so. I didn't dig that deeply, but I would assume that's it. But they did assert that type of claim.
They did assert that claim.
And this mediated settlement agreement resolved that claim, didn't it?
It would resolve any of the claims of contribution arising out of plaintiff's claims. So essentially, the NAG and reverse NAG kind of shuts down the injured employee's claims.
So you're saying, maybe I'm wrong, did Sullivan Day have an option to pursue a claim against you for this failure to get insurance?
That they did, and my guess is that was considered in the negotiations for the reverse NAG, because that dictates how much exposure they would have.
And so that claim is resolved?
Yes, as it regard to plaintiff's injuries. Whether or not they had insurance to cover or not would be a separate defense that they could bring up on the increased premium claim. So their argument and their third-party complaint is twofold. One, they're doing the common law contribution under 176061, subdivision 11. And then the second one is they're alleging a breach of contract claim against Demo Unlimited for not getting adding them as a named insured or an additional insured on their contract. And first of all, those are covered under two separate insurance policies, and that kind of gets into a different mess and behind the closed doors and what happens and who's covering what. But at this point, I don't believe that there was any insurance policy that was defending on that claim. It was just the builders group that was defending overall. But that claim basically says that Demo Unlimited agreed by the contract to pay for damages arising out of the negligence of Demo Unlimited. And that falls into one of the exceptions to the limited contribution claim, which also, again, ties right back to the workers' compensation subrogation interest, because if they can get more than the worker, if they have to pay more in contribution in the workers' compensation subrogation interest, that significantly diminishes their net recovery, which is why the $20,000 was agreed upon in the reverse NAG versus a lot more substantial money that was paid by the NAG to the plaintiff. So when you look at the consideration, those things were considered because the amount of workers' compensation benefits paid were high. And the other thing I would like to point out with the scope of release is if you look at what paragraph 5 says on what the parties agreed to release, they just said, plaintiff shall execute a release of all claims, and the settling party shall execute a stipulation of dismissal with prejudice of the legal action. The scope of release is only releasing this legal action. They didn't indicate that there would be a scope of stipulation for dismissal that would include any and all claims.
Right, but the stipulation for dismissal with prejudice by all parties means a dismissal of all claims that were raised or could have been raised.
Well, I think that if you look at what the definition of legal action here is, that, you know, again, this is just a very poorly written boilerplate, which is why, again, I think we need to look at what the parties actually added. The legal action isn't expressly defined, and it's referred to a couple times, and it says any and all claims that could be brought in the legal action, which indicates the legal action itself is what actually was brought, not what could have been brought. So then that scope of agreed upon execution of stipulations of dismissal also evidences the intent to just get rid of the plaintiff's claims and the subrogation claims and the third-party claims arising out of that, not the premium claim.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is Mike Tomshi. I represent respondent Sullivan Day. Judge Bradfold, I want to address some of the questions that you raised, because first of all, as I've read Demo Unlimited's materials, they say that no consideration was ever given for release of the increased premium claims. That is not true. In our view, when we settled this case, we intended to settle everything. That meant all claims that were or could have been brought by any of the parties, and the parties include Demo Unlimited, not Demo Unlimited's insurance company, the work comp carrier. So What we did was, and in this settlement, mediated settlement agreement, it broadly, as the court recognizes, broadly encompasses all claims that were or could have been brought. And they're rather dismissive of it, saying, well, that's boilerplate. It is boilerplate, because this court knows that it is the party's goal to have a resolution of the entire claim and not piecemeal it.
Well, the whole idea of a NAG settlement is to reserve some claims. And you're not saying that typically a NAG settlement, you're agreeing that would permit a future increased premium claim.
If all that was included was a reference to a NAG settlement, yes. But that's not all that was included. I would say this, and we've said it in our materials, and I want to make sure that we're clear here on the record. This handwritten comment about NAG and reverse NAG, if you look at it closely, all it does is reference dollar numbers. It doesn't even say...
But if it's common practice to use that type of settlement, and the parties understand that the reason you have that settlement is that it's an alternative to a release of all claims. It's not releasing all claims. It's releasing certain claims and permitting certain claims to go forward potentially in the future. So I think the if there is some ambiguity, that it would be in the common practice of using a settlement that is designed to only release certain claims at the same time that the contract has broad language releasing all claims. So I guess the question isn't just how do you reconcile the two, and you do that by saying it's dollar amounts. The question is also, is there more required if you say a NAG settlement and you intend to specifically also release a workers' comp increased premium claim? Is there more required of the parties drafting this document than simply saying NAG?
No, there isn't more required. When this mediated settlement agreement that is binding by all parties that signed it, which includes Demo Unlimited, says you're releasing all claims that were brought or could have been brought, it is all-encompassing. It's undisputed that they could have brought that increased premium claim in here and did not. The reference to the dollar numbers is how you're going to allocate the payment of $750,000. It doesn't say pursuant to a NAG release or a reverse NAG release. That language merely, and the reference to agrees to no comp future credit, it's all how you handle the money as between the people that are getting it. It doesn't impact the terms of our settlement, which were always going to be an entire settlement of all claims. And Judge Bradfold, you asked, my client asserted claims. There is a subcontract agreement that specifically stated that my client would be held harmless and indemnified by Demo Unlimited for all injury to all persons resulting from or in any manner connected with the execution of the work performed under the subcontract. It also required that Demo Unlimited obtain insurance to protect my client. They didn't do that. So we then brought an amended third-party complaint for contractual indemnity. And to be clear, this notion of 176.061 and the Fish and the Supreme Court decision that came out in 19, that involves common law contribution claims. It does not involve, this statutory scheme does not involve my client's claims for contractual indemnity or an obligation to insure. As a result, my client had significant claims. We paid $350,000 plus expert fees plus attorney's fees, which we possess in a claim against Demo Unlimited. And Demo Unlimited is trying to undo this deal so they can pursue a $150,000 increased premium claim. I have a claim that's worth at least three times more than that. So, and what I'm confused about here is that's what they want. Well, if that's what they want, then the district court did say on the record and in the order that if they have an increased premium claim, then I have a claim against them for $450,000, and that would be a set-off. So we shouldn't get there. We we approached this, we wanted to resolve this case, and that's what the parties did in a clear and unambiguous manner. The handwriting on it has nothing to do with the specific terms of the release. It has to do with the allocation of money. And there's this notion out there that the statute 48108 somehow impacts this case. In our view, the mediated settlement agreement under 572.34 is binding on the parties. The statute, the 48108, that involves the interaction and interplay between a client and a lawyer. It doesn't trump and undo the notion of a binding written settlement agreement under a mediated settlement agreement. And I would suggest that if that's the direction the court wants to go, we're going to be setting a very dangerous public policy perspective. We're now saying, is there going to be a test that we can assault or attack a mediated settlement agreement under 572.34 by later on someone saying, oh, I didn't have authority. The mediated settlement agreement was signed by an attorney for Demo Unlimited. The statute says it's binding if it's in writing. The 481 statute says if a lawyer has authority if he signs it and it's in writing. So this is a dispute between a lawyer and a client. It isn't a dispute that should undo what we thought was an entire settlement agreement. Thank you for your time.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name's Deborah Eklund, and I represent Moses Concrete. I don't have a lot to add, but I would like to go back to your question, Judge Bryan, just for a second, talking about if it was a neg, there'd still be things to do, or if so on.
I think the question was if, in common practice, the neg is understood to mean, as opposing counsel says, that you're reserving these types of claims, including an increased premium claim. If you include a NAG settlement or the word NAG somewhere in your document, are you then also, given that practice, required to say something more to make it clear that whether or not this workers' comp is included in the NAG portion?
Right, and that's what I want to address first. So there are some mediations we go to that have these exact same fact scenarios, and for whatever reason, we can settle with the plaintiff, but the work comp carrier won't have any of it. Just did one of those a couple weeks ago. So you enter a neg agreement with the plaintiff, okay? There are some mediations you go to, and for some reason, the work comp carrier wants to get rid of it, but the plaintiff's not quite ready, and you enter a reverse neg agreement. That isn't what happened here. We were all there. We were all ready. We were all intending to be completely finished. So this is a three-part settlement. There's a neg with the plaintiff. There's a reverse neg with the work comp subro people. And then there is a full and final. I know the word global's not in there, but to hearken what the district court said, then there's a global that took care of everything else. It took care of my client's cross-claims against Sullivan Day, Sullivan Day's cross-claims against us, our third-party complaint and claims against Demo. It was, you know, I keep going back to it.
Well, counsel, I think your actions after the mediated settlement agreement speak somewhat. I mean, you prepared a series of releases, and that's where we all found out that Demo did not agree,
right.
At least in their minds, did not agree to have a mutual release. So I want to back up just a little bit to the mediated settlement agreement, since I think that is the one document that all of our attention is focused on. So that document does say it anticipates that plaintiffs shall execute a release of all claims and the settling parties shall execute a stipulation of dismissal with prejudice of the legal action. So settling parties presumably would be everybody. Plaintiff is very specific. So it contemplates a release by the plaintiff. So one of the arguments that appellant has made is it didn't contemplate a release signed by, for instance, Demo. Mm-hmm. So if it didn't contemplate that, how could it be a global settlement, as you've argued?
Well, and my response to that is if there's going to be a neg and a reverse neg, the other parties necessarily have to sign off on it, mm-hmm. On the release. I mean, again, we've been accused of not understanding what a neg and a reverse neg is. Trust me when I tell you that if you've got a neg release, all the parties are going to sign off on it. And if you've got a reverse neg, that work comp insurer is going to sign off on it as well as the employer. That is, it's written into it. Just like what a neg means and just what like what a reverse neg means. The fact that all of those parties will sign off on it is included. It's just common knowledge. So I sit here and, you know, I kind of come back to one of your first questions, Judge Bratvold. I don't know how an attorney in Minnesota can read this and believe that these paragraphs in the middle have no meaning. Full and final release of all claims that were brought or could have been brought, signed by the attorney for Demo. Just like you asked earlier, if there was something that they wanted to maintain, then write it in. Write it in on the corner. Ask us if it's a, tell us that that's something that they want to keep. That didn't happen. That was never brought up, because if it had been, it would have been included in what was written at the end. And it just wasn't. And I can tell you from my client's point of view, we went into this mediation. We also paid a whole lot of money to be done. And if we can't trust that this release that says full and final settlement of all claims that were brought or could have been brought means you're done, if it doesn't mean you're done, then there's not a settlement agreement that's trustworthy right now. So I don't have anything else unless you have some questions.
Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I want to start off by apologizing for interrupting you and your slew of questions earlier. I got a little bit excited and ahead of myself. This is my first Court of Appeals argument, so it's a big day for me.
Well, you're doing very well, counsel, and we're glad to
Thank
have you.
You
here. Go right ahead.
I want to address two issues here. First, I want to address the position that the neg and reverse neg language is only how to deal with money. That isn't indicated in this document. They use specific terms of art that have specific limited scopes of release. And with the contractual indemnity argument about contribution, that falls under the scope of release in a reverse neg. And negs and reverse negs are not signed by all the parties. Neg releases are signed between the injured employee and the third-party tortfeasor. A reverse neg is signed between the third-party tortfeasor and the employer and the work comp insurer. It's not a global agreement. There never are global agreements, and a lot of times the one will be happening before the other. Here, they decided to do it on that basis at the same time, and my guess is that there were dual negotiations going on both of those bases. I bet you if we saw Mediator Kramer's yellow pad, it would have neg and reverse neg and different negotiations down in there. So
I'm sorry, counsel, I'm not following.
What I'm saying is that the negotiations were on a reverse neg and a neg basis, and there were no negotiations on a global basis. And that's indicated by the language in the documents.
Well, what impact does it have? We've talked a little bit about it already, but the contractual indemnity claim that is mentioned by Mr. Tomshi, you're saying that is covered by this release?
The contractual indemnity claim deals with the contribution claim for the work comp subrogation and then the general contribution against the plaintiff.
Well,
and in reverse neg, yes, I would argue that, yes, it does resolve. pardon me, yes, it does resolve all those claims, would be my position, that the contractual indemnity claim is raised to get out of subdivision 11, but it still all comes back to plaintiff's damages. And a neg and reverse neg is really meant to resolve the damages that plaintiff suffered. And in a subrogation claim and in most of these claims, you step into the shoes of the plaintiff. Here, plaintiff would never have been able to assert Demo Unlimited's increased premium claim. So by putting neg and reverse neg, they're indicating that they're just resolving the plaintiff's claims and that's it. There was no discussion ever in this lawsuit until we got a proposed global settlement about the increased premium claim. So the idea that they paid consideration for it doesn't make any sense because they didn't even know what it was.
Counsel, as I read the papers, and maybe I read them too quickly, that the proposed release submitted and discussed by the parties in this case was a global release among all of the direct defendants and the third-party defendant, your client,
yes,
right? It wasn't a specific release of the employer's increased premium claim. It would have included that because it was all-encompassing.
Yes, because they said, and my guess is the intention is, you know, this goes to my second point that I want to make here in rebuttal, is that I feel like what we're hearing and we're finding here today is that there was no meeting of the minds of what the neg and reverse neg language meant. We have respondents who are saying that that was just a way to allocate money, and then appellants who interpreted that to mean that the scope of release would be tied to those agreements.
So and are you moving away from your position, which when I read your brief, I thought you were saying this is an unambiguous document. We don't have to look at any of these other things. It's clear.
And it's clear from our point of view, yes. And it's clear, I think, from a basic contractual interpretation by following the rules. I think in an alternative argument, essentially, you know, for this position would be that if you do agree with respondents' intent in entering into this agreement, you have to look at also what the intent of the appellants were, and they just don't line up. I mean, appellants were not going into this mediation to settle an increased premium claim. We didn't represent them on the increased premium claim, in fact. I mean, that was, it wasn't the scope of our representation, and that goes into the authority issue as well.
Which is in the record before us, right?
Yes, yes. The authority issue, I mean, we do have the affidavit of Mark Pryor and the email from Demo Unlimited. And I think on the authority issue, it's fairly clear that the cases have required the agency express authority to be able to bind a client by writing or orally.
Didn't Mr. Pryor concede at the argument in this matter that this document was binding on his client? It just was a matter of interpretation?
He conceded that 48.1.08 applied. And it's, you know, I briefed it, and I guess is that, you know, we kind of missed on that one, but there was no actual waiver of the agreement, and the idea that he didn't understand what the argument was that he was waiving, and as we did further research into it, it came very clear that 48.108 does still require express authority, which we raised on appeal, and waiver of a right of a claim, you know, should be treated very highly and looked at very skeptically. And I believe that this court still has the right to address that. And if they need to, the remedy would be to send it back to the district court to review for authority.
Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate the arguments that have been submitted to us today. And the matter is now submitted to this court for its decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thanks again.
Thank you. Stay warm.
We're doing our very best.